Disc 2.
Chacon and I decided that in order to push the investigation to the next level, I should try to get an invitation to ride to Laughlin with the Mongols I'd met at the place. The Laughlin River Run is the third biggest annual motorcycle event in the country, ranking just behind Sturgis, South Dakota, and Daytona, Florida. But for Southern California bikers, it's the most important run of the year. The town of Laughlin, sometimes referred to as the poor man's Vegas, is situated on the Colorado River near Lake Mojave and Lake Mead on the Arizona-Nevada border, a relatively easy 5-hour drive from Los Angeles proper. A small town with year-round balmy weather, it has a population of around 10,000. But on the third weekend of April, the town swells with law-abiding Harley lovers, wannabes, and outlaws, about 25,000 of them. Along with them come plenty of motorcycle thefts, motorcycle traffic accidents, and outlaw gang rivalry incidents, in addition to the prevailing good-natured fun. My window of opportunity to get an invitation to Laughlin was narrowing fast. I assessed the personalities of all the Mongols I'd met so far. Rocky was a bad dude, to be sure, but he was nowhere near as hard an outlaw biker as Rancid. Buckethead, another member of the San Fernando Valley chapter, struck me as someone I might be able to get next to, but he was unpredictable and wasn't around as much as Rocky. It looked like Rocky was going to be my way in. I did some background work on him, and learned that he'd worked a legitimate job for the city of Los Angeles for 13 years, then joined the Mongols and had been on a downward spiral ever since. He had no convictions, but his arrest record boasted several assaults. I watched Rocky as he moved around the place, shooting pool and drinking beer. For an outlaw biker, he laughed a lot and seemed to get along with everyone. When I noticed his beer was nearly empty, I knew it was time to make my move. "Rocky!" I yelled over the jukebox as I passed him another cold bud. "Listen, you going to Laughlin?"
"Sure am. You going?"
"I want to, but I haven't found anybody to ride out with yet."
"Shit,"
Rocky said after a pause. "You ought to ride out with us." "I'd love to." I held my beer out as a salute. Rocky clinked his bottle against mine.
"Gonna be a fucking good time."
Though I tried my best to mask it, I was beside myself. I wanted to talk to Rocky about the particulars of the trip, but didn't dare push it. Tonight, I'd settle for the invite. Laughlin was a few days away, and I could get the details straight later. I bought Rocky another beer and shot a few more rounds of pool. At 2 in the morning, I high-fived Rocky. He repeated the invitation to ride with him, and I headed for the door. I couldn't wait to hook up with Chacon. I strapped on my helmet and fired my machine. I let go like someone had just dropped the green flag and disappeared into the night. For the next couple of days, I hung out at the place, trying to get Rocky to talk about just how we were going to do the Laughlin Run. But Rocky was as unreliable as he was unpredictable. His whole attitude had changed, and it seemed like he didn't want to go to Laughlin anymore. Tuesday rolled around to Friday, and we still had no plans for the Laughlin trip. Some of the Mongols had already rolled out Friday morning, and I was getting anxious. Why had his attitude changed? Had he suddenly started to distrust me? I was convinced that if I didn't say something to Rocky, the trip would be off. Shooting pool, I asked him straight out, "Rocky, what time we hitting the road in the morning?"
"Be at my place at about 9.
As I turned and walked out the door, a hardcore Tohunga chick followed me out. She'd obviously been eavesdropping on my conversation with Rocky.
"Billy, take me to Laughlin with you," she said.
I turned to look her up and down. She was a tough, typical biker chick, meaning she had a great body, but a face that could stop the space shuttle. She asked for a ride home. I smiled at her. Being seen leaving with her on the back of my Harley would do nothing but lend credence to my role as Billy St. John, both tonight and on the Laughlin Run.
"Jump on. Where you live?"
"Just head down Foothill Boulevard. I'll show you."
She reached around me and tightened up as I pulled away. As we rolled down Foothill, I told her that if she really wanted to go to Laughlin, she should meet me at the place at about 8:30 in the morning. In my rearview mirror, I saw Chacon tailing me. I knew that he would be waiting to hear what the plans were for Laughlin. He had a group of agents on standby ready to roll out to Nevada with me. I dropped the chick off, and Chacon jumped in behind me. I signaled him to follow me as I turned onto Lowell Avenue, then picked a dark parking lot at a driving range near the 210 for our meet. There wasn't much to discuss besides Rocky's sudden reluctance about the trip. I rolled my bike around in the parking lot and pulled up next to Chacon's car. "We still on? What'd he say?" "I'm going to meet Rocky at his house at 9 in the morning. He didn't say anything else about meeting with other Mongols or anything else about the trip."
"Who's the chick?"
"Just some TJ chick who wants me to take her to Laughlin." Chacon smiled knowingly.
"It'll be good cover."
"Yeah, it will." I hadn't yet worn a concealed surveillance device, or wire, at this point in the investigation. I was still too new on the scene, and there was far too great a risk that Rocky or one of the other Mongols might suddenly try to pat me down. Getting caught wearing a wire in a closed criminal society like the Mongols, or any outlaw motorcycle gang for that matter, is an almost certain death sentence. Rather, Chacon and his gang would follow us, and I'd make contact through a payphone, if I could. I rode home, uneasy, trying to tell myself everything was going to go according to plan. I couldn't help but feel the whole operation was coming down to tomorrow. My mind played games with me. The night seemed darker, and the trip home longer. I was up before dawn, making sure that I had myself together. I still wasn't feeling too confident about the whole situation, but I called Chacon and told him that I was ready to roll and that I'd be leaving for Tohunga in a few minutes. He told me to be careful. I turned off Lowell onto Foothill Boulevard and rode down the hill. I was surprised to see the little Tohunga chick waiting for me in front of the place. I pulled over, and she hopped on, wrapping her hands tight around my waist. It was still too early to roll to Rocky's place, so I told her that we'd hit a restaurant down the street before we picked him up. Like Sue, this chick was a hardcore tweaker, but unlike a lot of tweakers, she still had quite an appetite. I watched her shoveling down the pancakes and sausages. I didn't say a thing to her throughout the meal besides, "Pass the salt." I was too focused on what would be waiting for me at Rocky's house. Rocky lived a minute's ride down the road, and we were in front of his place before I could work myself into a more negative mindset. I backed my bike to the curb. It seemed more like 5 in the morning than 9. There was nothing to indicate that anyone in the house was alive as I banged my fist against the door. After 2 minutes, Rocky's old lady came to the door. Her name was Vicky, and as I was to learn in the coming months, she and Rocky had been childhood sweethearts. Her face was weathered, and her eyes had the vacant look of a long-term dopehead. Vicky let us in, mumbling something about Rocky being still in bed, told us to hang on, and turned and walked back toward the bedroom. In a few minutes, Rocky emerged, looking half dead.
"Oh, fuck, Billy, what time is it?"
9.
"Come back about 11.
I nodded. At least he didn't say the trip was off.
Okay, Rock, see you in a couple of hours.
The TJ chick and I walked back to my bike. She started complaining, saying that she needed to go back to her place and pick up some dope for the trip. I figured I'd better drop her off, then tell her that I'd changed my mind about going. "Look, baby," I said as I pulled into her driveway, "I don't think I'm going to Laughlin anymore. Think I'm just gonna head home." She sighed a few times and tried to talk me into making the run, but to no avail. I headed back up Foothill Boulevard to find a phone so I could let Chacon know what was going on. I told him that Rocky was still asleep and wanted us to come back about 11.
"No big deal," Chacon said, "as long as we made the trip."
I tried to put on a good face. Chacon and a team of ATF agents were fired up for the run to Laughlin, and I didn't want to let them down. There was no one at the place at this hour, but the R&J motorcycle shop next door was open and I strolled inside. R and J stood for Roy and Johnny. The proprietors were two old-school Harley-Davidson mechanics, disorganized, rough, and dirty, but they knew their way around a Harley like no one else on the Rock. I made my way back through the jumble of motorcycle parts.
Yo, anybody home?
Come on in,
hollered a deep voice from the back. I found Johnny doing surgery on a Harley engine in his little shop area.
What's up, Billy?
Just fixing to take off for Laughlin.
Who are you rolling with?
Rocky. Johnny looked up from the Harley, raised one eyebrow at me. His look spoke volumes. Although not one percenters, Johnny and Roy could hang with the best of them. But they had better sense than to put on a patch. They knew what it meant and wanted nothing to do with it. One evening after Johnny had seen me hanging with the Mongols, he came up to me, put his arm around my shoulder, and with all the sincerity in the world told me,
Billy, stay away from that brother's shit. If you get involved with them, you'll come out a loser.
Johnny didn't have a clue who I really was, of course, but after that piece of advice, he held a special place in my heart. At 10:30, I decided to head back to Rocky's. If I let too much time pass, it would just give him an excuse to bail out of the trip. As I rolled up to Rocky's place, I tried to be as noisy as hell.
Yo, Rocky!
I shouted, banging repeatedly on the door. After a long wait, I saw some signs of Mongol life. The lock jiggled, then the door opened, and Dickie stood staring uncomprehendingly, like I'd just woken her from the deepest sleep of her life.
What are you doing here, Billy? Rocky's still in bed.
Can I come in and talk to him? I walked straight back to the bedroom where Rocky lay, snoring, twisted up in his sheets.
Yo, bud, I said. We going?
Yeah, give me a little longer. Come back in an hour.
I wanted to stay at Rocky's place so that he couldn't change his mind, but I knew better than to push it. I fired up my bike, drove back to the place, and killed the hour drinking beers with Karina's father, the retired LAPD officer. I talked to him as if there was no love lost between Billy St. John and the LAPD. He made it clear that he and the LAPD were no mutual admiration society either. Over the course of the investigation, I had numerous talks with him about his life as a cop. And though he'd retired under favorable circumstances, he just seemed to be one of those guys disgruntled by their whole police career. All of the Mongols treated him as a harmless old man, convinced that he'd never inform on them for any criminal activity that went down in the place. I sometimes stared at him as I drank my beer and wondered how a guy who'd spent 20 years chasing bad guys could feel so at home in a hornet's nest of outlaw bikers. But he always treated me above board, and I didn't worry much about him. Chacon, on the other hand, felt I should steer clear of him as much as possible. Who knew if he was still capable of using his LAPD connections to do some background digging on me? I nursed my beer for that hour, then fired up the bike again, wondering if Rocky was going to give me some new excuse about not making the trip. My heart came alive as I saw him outside his house, working on his bike. I backed my straight pipes to the curb.
You ready to roll?
Rocky had the side cover off his bike and was sticking an American Arms .22 caliber revolver under it. Things were looking up. Vicky walked out with her leather jacket and helmet. Rocky kicked and cursed and cursed and kicked until he hit the right combination and the bike cranked up. Then he stood there for a few minutes, breathing heavily, exhausted from the ordeal. He stood there so long, I worried that he'd run out of gas. Then he guided the machine through the maze of dogs, toys, broken Harley parts, and assorted Tohunga trash that littered his yard as he made his way to the street. Vicky climbed on the back, and we were on our way to Laughlin. Soon, I'd be partying with a shitload of the black and white bad guys for an entire weekend. We stopped a couple of times for gas and burgers. Each time I'd look around to catch a glimpse of Chacon or some other ATF agent attempting to surveil us as covertly as possible.
Seeing those ATF follow cars made me a bit uneasy. If I could see them watching us, I knew Rocky or Vicky could do the same. We rolled into Laughlin somewhere around 10 that night and made our way to the Riverside Resort Hotel, the Mongol stronghold in Laughlin. Every bike was adorned with black and white Mongol stickers, and at least two Mongol prospects were guarding the roped-off parking area. I killed the engine and dropped the kickstand. Two Mongols approached Rocky and greeted him with Mongol handshakes and hugs. He introduced me as a hangaround, telling them that it would be okay for my bike to be parked in the Mongol circle. The two Mongol brothers welcomed me, which helped to ease some tension. Rocky, Vicky, and I made our way to the hotel. For some reason, the atmosphere seemed to grow more businesslike, like we were a combat unit readying ourselves for an attack. I overheard one of the Mongols telling Rocky that there was a meeting in one of the hotel rooms in about a half an hour. Something was up. Rocky turned to me, whispering, "Billy, there's some kind of fucking mix-up. We ain't got a room." He turned and walked away. Vicky had hooked up with another Mongol's woman and left me by myself. At least it would be a good chance to put in a call to Chacon. Later in the case, I had an ATF cell phone I could use in such situations to check in with my backup, but now I had to make do with a payphone. There was a bank of phones near the hotel entrance, and I quickly made my way there to put in a call. No answer. I called the room where ATF had a small command center. No answer there either. I tried Chacon's cell again and left a message. "Yo, I'm here at the Riverside. Something's up. Rocky didn't have his shit together, and we don't have a room to stay in." I glanced around, but no one had seen me talking on the phone. I was tired and I wanted a place to sleep. There was no way I was going to stay up all night. Not being a meth amphibian myself, I was going to have to find some place to lay my head. I went to the check-in line and waited my turn. I got the standard line about the hotel being booked up, then went down to the manager's office and told him I was with the Mongols. He turned on his computer, punched in a few digits, then asked me for my credit card. So the Mongols' reputation did sling some weight here at the Riverside. With two room keys in hand, I went back to tell Vicky, "Hey, I got us all a room." "How'd you swing that?" "Shit, I'm a VIP around here." I smiled at her and told her the room number. "Tell Rocky I'm up there getting some sleep." When I unlocked the door, I saw that the room had only one bed. Ah, well. I'd win a few more points and curl up on the floor, leaving the king-size bed for Rocky and his old lady. I made myself a pallet of blankets and pillows on the carpet, and was so tired I fell into a very deep sleep. Much later in the night, I heard Rocky and Vicky unlocking the door. I kept my eyes closed, pretending to be asleep, while listening to what they had to say. "This Billy's okay, you know," Rocky said. "I can't believe he's sleeping on the floor in his own fucking room." The next morning, I was up around 9. Rocky and Vicky were snoring away as I showered, dressed, and headed down for breakfast. I saw a couple of Mongols at the restaurant, but didn't say anything to them. In the strict but unspoken etiquette of outlaw bikers, it would have been out of place for me, a nobody, to engage a full patch in conversation. I ate a meal of bacon and eggs, put in a surreptitious phone call to Chacon, then headed back to the room. Rocky and Vicky were up and moving about. It was uncomfortable trying to make conversation and waiting for them to get ready for the day. The TV helped make the time pass. Then, just as we were getting ready to leave, Rocky reached into his Mongol vest and retrieved a clear plastic bag containing a white powder that appeared to be either coke or methamphetamine. He held it up in front of my face as he reached for a Bowie knife strapped to his side. He pulled the gleaming blade, then turned toward a table, cut a hole at the top of the plastic bag, and let the powder pour out onto the tabletop. He used his Bowie to separate out two heavy lines. I watched as he bent over and snorted up one of the lines. I was praying that the other was for Vicky. No such luck. Rocky turned toward me, raising the knife and holding the blade inches from my face.
Is that line too heavy for you?
It wasn't an offer. This was a challenge. I hoped Rocky couldn't see my face turning red as I answered, "No, Rock. Looks good to me." I walked around Rocky and his knife to the bathroom, telling him that I had to take a piss first. I stared at myself in the bathroom mirror. What the hell was I going to do? I couldn't stall Rocky for long. If I didn't do the line, there was a good chance he was going to swing that Bowie knife. More important, the investigation would be over. On the other hand, if I did snort the meth, I'd have to get out of the hotel as soon as possible, call Chacone, make my way to the hospital, and start the arduous process of paperwork for an agent who's been forced to use drugs during an undercover operation. And I could tell that Rocky wasn't planning to let me just wander off for a few hours in the middle of the Laughlin run. He'd know something was wrong and never trust me again. The whole operation was coming down to these next few seconds. I left the bathroom and, without any further hesitation, asked Rocky for his straw. "Just roll up a fucking dollar bill," he said. My hand was shaking as I reached in my pocket for the bill. Rocky and Vicky watched closely as I rolled the dollar up into a thin cylinder. I looked at Rocky, then at the white line, waiting for me. Suddenly, I saw my chance. Rocky and Vicky were near the bed. If I moved right now, I could place myself between the meth and them. With my back to them, maybe I could wipe it off the table without them seeing. But if I calculated wrong, Rocky would put his knife right through me. I moved between Rocky and the dope. Bending over and holding the dollar bill in my right hand, I snorted hard right next to the dope while wiping it off the table with my cupped left hand. I straightened up fast as Rocky looked around me at the table. The dope was gone, and I pretended to snort through my nose a few more times. Rocky grinned at me, staring at my face hard.
"Good shit, huh, Billy?"
"Ooh-wah!"
I let out a loud rebel yell, then shook my head from side to side. "Yeah, Rock, oh, some good shit!" "Let's go." Rocky, energized by the shot of crank, jumped to his feet. I looked down to see a small pile of meth on the carpet below the table. Quickly, I put my boot over it, scattering it into the carpet. "Yeah, let's go." I turned to follow Rocky and Vicky out the door. Had I really gotten away with this sleight of hand? Maybe they'd seen, but were just waiting to call my bluff when there were more Mongols present. I couldn't have pulled off the same stunt if even one more biker had been in the room with me. And I knew I couldn't keep doing it all weekend. I'd have to figure out another way to get around the dope issue, or this investigation wasn't going to last another day. Downstairs in the lobby, we met up with the San Fernando Valley chapter president, a frightening-looking guy named Domingo. Domingo was a little younger than Rocky, maybe in his late 20s, with long black hair that he wore in a heavy braid that fell all the way to his belt. A light-skinned Hispanic, he was built like a fire plug, only 5'8", but at least 225 pounds. His arms were very muscular and tatted up pretty good. I later read up on Domingo's criminal history. He'd just come out of prison for his involvement in a nightclub melee and running gunfight the Mongols had engaged in just outside of Los Angeles. A victim had been found shot dead at the scene, but the police could never bring a charge of murder, and Domingo went to state prison on a conviction of felony assault. I also learned that Domingo had originally been patched in with the L.A. chapter, but with some recent internal turmoil in the San Fernando Valley, he had been sent by the national president to clean up shop there. Rocky and Domingo greeted each other with a Mongol handshake, and I heard Rocky tell Domingo in a half whisper, "Yeah, he's okay." Domingo nodded at me, didn't offer me a handshake. We met up with more Mongols as we made our way to the concession and display area in the hotel parking lot. It was warm outside. Rock music was blaring from a live band on the stage. Cold beer was flowing. Nothing makes Mongols happier than loud music and a plentiful supply of beer, except maybe beating the shit out of an enemy. But for now, there was nobody to beat up, and plenty of beer to go around. The Mongols began to circle the wagons, and now I learned the reason that everyone was on high alert. The Vagos were in town, and they had put out the word that they were looking for some Mongol ass. It seemed to me that they weren't looking very hard. The Mongols were gathering en masse and flying their colors in an awesome public display of force. Rocky told me to look tough and to stand guard at one of the corners. He said I should do what I was told by other Mongol patches and not ask any questions. You got that, Billy? Don't ask questions. Rocky was vouching for me now. I stood in the hot sun looking as serious and tough as I could, keeping lookout for any Vagos. I was a legitimate Mongol hang-around now, the precursor to being an official prospect, and as such, I was trusted with guard duty. On an ATF intelligence report, I'd be listed as Billy St. John, known associate, Mongols, MC. On Sunday afternoon, it was time to head back to L.A. We had a 2-hour delay just outside Laughlin to fix Rocky's piece-of-shit bike. When we reached the split in the 10 and 210 freeways, Rocky pulled off at the Fairplex exit in Pomona. I followed. At this junction, we would go our own ways. Rocky maneuvered his bike into a closed service station. It was dark, and the ride home had taken its toll on all of us. Parking his bike, Rocky went to a phone booth, as Vicky and I found an uncomfortable piece of concrete curb to sit on. I remember watching Rocky walking away, his fearsome black and white Mongol patch fading into the darkness in front of me. I reflected on the weekend's progress. I was sitting in some abandoned service station with a gangster who had taken me under his wing. If he knew who I really was, he would kill me right here. He had the gun to do it. The place was dark, and there would be no witnesses. The noise from the freeway traffic would muffle the sound of the gunshot. Rocky walked back after a couple of minutes and sat down beside me on the curb. You got any idea what you're doing? The question startled me. What? I said, staring at him. You heard me. You're trying to get into something that might kill you. Do you know that? I wasn't sure what my answer should be. This ain't no club, Rocky continued. We're outlaws. I've had to do things that would send me to prison for years if I got caught. You ready for that? Would you kill for the Mongols? Because that's what you might have to do. We're outlaws, Billy. You need to know that. You need to be sure. You need to understand what you're getting into. Without waiting for an answer, he patted me on the back. I'm out of here. You think about it, Billy. I watched as Rocky and Vicky got on their bike and roared away. The freeway traffic echoed through my head. I was tired. As I fired up my Harley again, I realized that I had no idea what I was really getting into. Chapter 5. In the beginning, our investigative goals were relatively modest. We were trying to get next to Rocky, Domingo, and some of the other San Fernando Valley Mongols, buy some methamphetamine and cocaine, and get as many illegal guns off the street as we could. To be honest, if I'd known the way it was going to play out, I'm not sure I would have taken the assignment. Though I'd been through the deep cover ordeal before, it was usually a matter of days or weeks at a time away from my family. At the start of the operation, I'd been divorced for about 10 years. My ex-wife and I remained cordial. She lived in Riverside, in a modest suburban community, with our 2 sons. My boys were then 9 and 10 years old. And even with the demands of being an ATF agent, I was there almost every weekend, took them to soccer games, went to school plays and parent-teacher conferences. In those months when I began to hang around the Mongols, my sons could see the visible changes in me, my hair and beard growing longer, my unkempt appearance so unlike my usual close-cropped, clean-shaven look. They were just old enough to ask questions, but not old enough to understand the sacrifices and demands of a deep undercover assignment. Not that I could have told them too much, even if I'd wanted to. It's one of the cardinal rules of undercover work. You never know who might blow your cover. What kind of casual remark, even out of the mouth of a child, could have devastating repercussions. The safest thing is to always keep your friends and loved ones in the dark about the specifics of your assignment. Of course, they understand that you're doing some kind of top-secret law enforcement work, but beyond that, the nature of your job, the specifics of any deep cover case, can only hurt them in the long run. On a cool spring night in Los Angeles, where motorcycle riding is a year-round mode of transportation, I was trying to take the investigation to that next level, making my first undercover foray into the Mongols' stronghold in East L.A. Tony's Hofbräu is a notorious old-time biker bar located in a small enclave just outside downtown Los Angeles. East L.A. is a primarily Hispanic community in the shadows of the city's mirrored skyscrapers, where the smells of cilantro and habanero chili peppers waft through the warm breezes, carried along with mariachi music, rap, and rock. Small, well-maintained houses with gated yards and nurtured gardens co-mingle with tenement housing projects. The older, honest, hard-working generation lives side by side with the younger, hot-headed criminal element, the God-fearing with the gangbangers. And it was here in East L.A. that the Mongols were most at home. As I turned onto Valley Boulevard from the Long Beach Freeway, I rolled on the throttle of my Harley. It wasn't long before the sea of bikes came into view, truly an awesome sight. There were easily 80 to 90 motorcycles lined up, standing curbside sentry in front of Tony's Hofbräu. Rounding that corner, I felt a sharp pang in my gut, the kind I'd felt rolling into the A Shaw Valley in Vietnam back in 1971. Here I was again, about to go to war, only on a far different battlefield. There was no platoon to back me up this time, and no one else to look out for. The only ass on the line was mine. I slowed the Harley down as I approached my target. Slowly they came into view, dark, shadowy figures that seemed, at first glance, like some mob of grim reapers. With no obvious place to park my motorcycle, I cruised past the hordes of rough, bearded, tattooed, black leather-clad Hispanic bikers. Predator and prey, eye to eye. I'd been feeling awkward and nervous to begin with, and now my entire body tensed as I finally reached a break in the asphalt real estate where I could park my hog. Streetlights were either in short supply or purposely rendered inoperative, and the darkness enveloped everything. I could hear the blare of Latino music even from a considerable distance. I backed the bike to the curb, the straight pipes grumbling that famous Harley idle like some mechanical beast. In the space of that moment, I asked myself what I'd gotten into and told myself that it still wasn't too late to get out. I sat for what seemed like an eternity before I cut the engine. I took a deep breath and repeated my undercover mantra, "Suck it up, Billy. It's game time. You'll come out of this one day and watch all these bad guys parading in handcuffs." I took my helmet off and placed it over the mirror on my handlebars. I pulled down the bandana I'd been wearing over my mouth like some black hat gunslinger in a John Wayne movie. I got off the bike, hoping my legs wouldn't betray my nerves. I could feel dozens of Mongols staring at me from a heavy darkness my vision couldn't penetrate. Trying desperately not to be conspicuous, I took a quick look around for Chacon's Pontiac. He was nowhere in sight, but I knew he was out there somewhere, keeping an eye on me. All I could feel was the pounding of my heart and the fear that my T-shirt would show the vibration. I was truly alone, but there was no turning back. For an undercover agent, fear can be a good thing. When you've got it under control and can make it work in your favor, it keeps your guard up and your edge sharp. However, if you let it control you, fear quickly becomes your worst enemy. With my mission clear, but my plan tenuous, I didn't need any more enemies. As I walked toward the bar, the music got louder, and the shadowy figures more distinct. I walked as if pulled by a force I couldn't see, past Mongols in their full regalia of black leather vests with the assortment of patches that can be read like an outlaw's roadmap. There were small rectangular bars stitched on the left chest, reflecting the various chapters and the club officers' ranks. The purple heart patch, meaning that a member had been shot while in combat for the gang. The skull and bones patch, signifying that a member had committed murder for the gang. And a multitude of colored wings that I recognized to be club-sanctioned trophies, indicating that a member had engaged in acts of group sex and varieties of cunnilingus while being observed by other members of the gang. I had almost reached the front door when a huge Mongol warrior blocked my path and shouted,
"Private party, dude!"
Since my options were few, largely due to his size and my desire to see another day, I stopped in my tracks and looked up at him. Bravado kicked in. "I'm Billy. I'm a guest from San Fernando Valley." The gateway guard took my meaning. I'd been formally invited by the SFV Mongol chapter.
"Where's Domingo?" he asked.
"I don't know. I thought he was here." I could have been Christ at the Second Coming, but my words would have meant nothing without the validation of the San Fernando Valley chapter president.
"Wait here," he said, as he turned to walk back toward the pack of Mongols I'd passed.
I looked at his colors as he walked away. Worn, dirty, in a way that only outlaw bikers and those who know them can understand. His colors gave up his secrets. They spoke of who he was and much of what he'd done. In the same way a soldier or cop's uniform can be, his patch was intimidating in its own right. His size and surliness did nothing to temper that effect. With the mariachi music blaring behind me, I could see him talking to a figure cloaked in the street's darkness. He was looking back and forth between me and whoever he was talking to. The longer he talked, and the more he looked back and forth, the more nervous I became. I steeled myself for whatever came my way, as much as I was hoping he'd just come back and say, "Okay, man, go on in, have a good time." I knew an ass-whipping, or worse, was just as likely. Mongols think nothing of hurting people, men or women, friends or foes. Here I was, an unknown, solitary dude claiming to be a guest. For them, kicking my ass would have taken about as much forethought as lighting a cigarette. He finally turned and walked back toward me. After an agonizing pause, he looked me up and down and said, "Come on, dude. You gotta talk to Red Dog." Red Dog. Little did I realize that those two words were the beginning of a constant misery that would last for the next 2 years. Somewhere between despair and terror, I followed like a hound on a leash back to the group of Budweiser swilling Mongols I'd been watching a minute before. They were assembled in a semicircle around one figure. He stood out like a neon stop sign on a deserted highway. Obviously, this was Red Dog. 6 feet tall and muscular, he wore his Mongol patch slung over a long black duster. His hair was a fiery red, and his face had that ruddy alcoholic complexion and a thick red mustache that extended well below his chin. He had a bandana around his head and wore sunglasses. That, along with a ton of prison tattoos, made his appearance all the more sinister. I was ushered forward like a peasant before his king. Knowing this was no time to show any signs of weakness, I extended my hand. "Hey, I'm Billy from San Fernando Valley." There was no indication that Red Dog even considered returning the gesture. He just stood there and stared at me. This was a tactic, as I would later learn, that he routinely used to intimidate friends and enemies alike. I dropped my hand and waited. The ensuing silence was a good tactic, too. It kept me on edge. After a long wait, Red Dog said,
"You know a chick named Sue?"
He might as well have been screwing a gun into my ear. Shit! I'd known from that first glance in the Rosebell parking lot that my tweaker chick CI was going to be trouble down the road. And just a few days earlier, Domingo had told me that Sue was shooting off her mouth about being pissed off at the Mongols, that she'd said she was going to pay them back big time. Domingo thought that she might try to bring an undercover cop into the gang. Domingo had turned to me and said, "Billy, you might be that undercover cop." And then he waited, staring, studying my face for a reaction. If good news travels fast, bad news travels faster. The Mongol grapevine about Sue's bad intentions had obviously gotten back to Red Dog. "Yeah, Red Dog, I know Sue, but not any better than anyone else at the place. Hell, I met her at a funeral. That's all I know about her." It was pretty close to the truth. "Look, if this chick is gonna be a problem," Red Dog cut me off. He took a step toward me, got right down on my face so I could smell the stench from his stale beer breath. "Billy, if you turn out to be a problem, I'll cut your motherfucking throat." It was like getting hit in the face with a wet squirrel. I wasn't quite sure how to respond, so I didn't say anything. Then, to my relief, Red Dog nodded to his soldier. "Let him in." "Thanks, Red Dog." As I turned away, I wondered if I was thanking him for letting me in or for not cutting my throat. Either way, it didn't seem to make much difference. I walked through the door of Tony's. It was standing room only. A live band blared some mongrelized, unrecognizable amateur rock. Mongols were shouting their profane conversations over the blare of Fender guitars. One percenters were everywhere, and there were plenty of ladies who looked willing to become the property of the patches. I couldn't help but notice one chick in particular, who was obviously quite proud of her half-covered breasts. They were big and apparently really hers, but they matched the huge gut that hung over her belt. Both were prominently displayed for all to see. If I was going to be spending much time with this gang, I hoped that they occasionally attracted better-looking women. I moved toward the bar, being careful not to step in front of any patches. I hollered, "Budweiser," at the bartender. It was becoming painfully obvious, at least to me, just how out of place I was, a white boy in the middle of 100 Hispanic bikers. I shook off my self-consciousness and decided to try my best to mix in. I drifted through Tony's, Budweiser in hand. I was picking up pointers quickly, such as when I patted a Mongol on the back and congratulated him on a good pool shot. He looked at me, grinned his outlaw grin, and politely told me that if I ever touched his patch again, he'd wrap his cue stick around my head. I believed him. Lesson learned, don't touch a Mongol's colors. Shooting pool is a mainstay of the biker lifestyle. So is getting shit-faced on Jack Daniels and being an asshole, but I decided to try pool first. It could be either my ride in or my ticket to the intensive care unit. I've been shooting pool since I was a kid and figured I could handle the competition. But I couldn't help wondering if beating a few Mongols at pool would constitute some kind of disrespect. The first Mongol patch I played was good, but he only got off one shot before I ran the table. After sinking the eight ball, I looked up to see him coming straight for me with his cue stick clenched in his fist like a club. I straightened up and tightened my grip on my own stick. To my shock, he lowered the cue and extended his free hand. He was the first Mongol to do so all night.
"Good shooting," he said. "Name's Lucifer."
"Billy from San Fernando Valley, I'm a guest." He nodded.
"Where's Domingo?"
Shit, how many times was I going to have to dance around this question? "I'm not sure," I told Lucifer. Luckily, it was only a few minutes before Domingo and Rocky and the rest of the San Fernando Valley chapter strolled lazily into Tony's. I was never so glad to see a group of Mongols as I was at that moment. Instantaneously, the entire atmosphere changed. Domingo introduced me around and things settled down, including what was left of my nerves. I shot pool with Rocky and Domingo, downed beer, told jokes, talked motorcycles, and was actually having a pretty decent time, until Red Dog, who I had by now learned held the official rank of National Sergeant at Arms, came in from the street. Things went downhill fast when he showed up at our pool table. Not content to just make me feel uncomfortable, Red Dog was on a campaign to let as many Mongols as possible know that he was going to be taking a personal interest in riding my ass. He loudly told Domingo that if an undercover cop was brought into the club, it wouldn't be just the cop's ass. It would be Domingo's as well. He said it as much for my benefit as Domingo's. I watched Domingo as he racked up the balls. He was pretty good at letting Red Dog's abuse roll off his back. Although perhaps a little bit suspicious of me, Domingo didn't really believe I was a cop. He patted me on the back as we shot pool. "Relax, Billy. Just have a good time tonight." Last call in California is 2 a.m. No Mongol party in a licensed bar winds down before then. I looked at my watch and assessed the evening's progress. I was still in one piece. My body parts hadn't been rearranged. I was convincingly holding my own in conversations with hardcore one percenters. People were drifting and staggering through the exit, and I figured it was as good a time as any to do the same. I shook hands with Domingo, Rocky, and the San Fernando Valley guys and headed for the door. I made it to the sidewalk just in time to see Red Dog standing by my Harley. He wasn't even trying to be discreet. He had a pen and paper out and was copying down the license number on my motorcycle. I had no place to go without looking like I was avoiding him, so I kept walking straight to my hog. Red Dog looked up when he saw me. He gave me a brazen stare. It was like catching a bear rummaging in your trash can. He took a few steps toward me and hissed, "I'm gonna find out who you really are." As I climbed onto my bike, I noticed another Mongol standing in the dark watching me as I prepared to leave. All kinds of thoughts started running through my head. Do they know who I am? Are they going to follow me home? I cranked my bike and headed for the freeway, looking more in my rearview mirror than at the road in front of me. There was no way I could even consider risking a meet with Chacon. I headed back to my undercover apartment, giving any Mongol who might be following me a run for his money. 17 years of working undercover assignments gave me an edge on shaking tails. I wove in and out of traffic, running at over 100 miles per hour every now and then, sure to unnerve even an experienced tail. By the time I made it to my undercover apartment, I was positive no one had followed me. I cruised on in, parked the bike in the carport, went upstairs, and collapsed onto my sofa, still wearing my leather jacket and motorcycle boots. At the start of the Memorial Day weekend, Domingo told me to meet them at the place at 9 a.m. This would be my first official organized outing with the Mongols. At 9 sharp, like a well-disciplined soldier, I was standing in front of the place. My sleeping bag and the accoutrements I'd need for the weekend were tied on my bike. By the time 9:30 rolled around, there was still no Mongols at the place. I knew that there wasn't anything that the SFV chapter did punctually, so I killed some time talking to my buddies Roy and Johnny at the R&J motorcycle shop. Sometime after 10, Karina's dad showed up to open the place for business. There were already a handful of Tohunga locals craving their morning spirits. The only appropriate thing to do was to go in and join them. I'd been inside for about 30 minutes when I heard the unmistakable roar of mechanical thunder outside. In just a matter of seconds, the street in front of the place was filled with black-clad Mongols on their iron horses. A loud voice pierced that thunder. "Yo, Billy, let's roll!" I went straight to my bike, grabbed my helmet off the mirror, put it on, and mounted up all in one motion. I gave the kickstand a nudge with my boot. The blast from my pipes matched those of the pack, and with a roar like that of a squadron of FA-18s, we were off. The pack moved in unison, and as a lowly hangaround, I assumed my position at the rear, sucking up the requisite amount of burnt motorcycle oil and exhaust. Every now and then I would have to duck out of the way of mirrors and other motorcycle parts that flew off the bikes ahead of me. I was awed by their stunning display. We made our way across Los Angeles to a cemetery on the southeast side of town, where we met up with what seemed to be the entire Mongol nation. As we parked amid the rows of bikes, other Mongols welcomed our pack with the traditional loud clapping Mongol handshakes, as well as hugs and kisses. To outsiders, Mongols are as deadly as a pride of lions, but among themselves, they can be remarkably loyal, kind, and affectionate. After the greetings, everyone moved toward a particular gravesite. They surrounded the headstone of a fallen brother who'd been killed 2 decades earlier during the original war with the Hell's Angels. And with reverence, the Mongols' national vice president conducted roll call for the members of Chapter 13, the brothers who have died and whose memory is revered by club members. Strict military-style decorum was maintained until the ceremony concluded. As a Vietnam vet, I was moved by the respect and sincerity shown by these wild-haired, tattooed, knife-scarred men. The silence was broken when a solitary Mongol screamed,
"Who are we?"
Everyone responded with a Mongol fight song. "We are Mongol raiders. We're raiders of the night. We're dirty sons of bitches. We'd rather fuck and fight. Hua! We castrate the sheriffs with a dirty piece of glass and shove our rusty buck knives up their fucking ass. Hua! Heidi, Heidi, Christ almighty, who the fuck are we? Shit, fuck, cunt, suck, Mongols, MC. Hua!" The memorial ceremony broke up, and the Mongol nation erupted in a frenzy of life. We were headed to Simi Valley for a massive party weekend. Directions were handed out only when Mongols were mounting their bikes. Ever vigilant of being tailed by the law, the Mongol leadership had decided that no one was allowed to know the run's destination prior to this moment. And who but an overeager cop would want to crash a Mongol party?
"Fire 'em up!"
And there was a thunderous roar of Harleys, panheads, shovelheads, Evos, softtails, FLHTCs, and so on, as we began to roll out of the cemetery. More than 150 bikes formed into ranks, winding through the streets of Los Angeles like a great anaconda. Under Red Dog's direction, the sergeants-at-arms from the various chapters blatantly blocked intersections like rent-a-cops as the procession moved through the city. With impunity, we blew right past real cops, stunned LAPD officers, overwhelmed California Highway Patrolmen, as well as red lights, stop signs, speed limits. No law had any bearing on this outlaw army. As we rode through one intersection after another at breakneck speed, I realized that the Mongol nation, like those shrieking warriors on horseback terrorizing the known world under Genghis Khan, were in absolute control of any territory they occupied. After a trek of some 40 miles, the procession rolled into a campground on the west side of Simi Valley, an upscale bedroom community on the easternmost edge of Ventura County, at the border with Los Angeles. After such a well-orchestrated caravan from the cemetery to the campground, I expected something similar in the selection of camping areas. What actually took place, though, was a kind of Chinese fire drill. We rode around the area looking for what we felt would be a good area for the SFV chapter to set up shop. Like a prognosticator with a divining rod, Domingo stopped and declared a specific territory as ours. We all began to stake out our particular spots. Assuming my rightful position, I had to defer to all the patches and their women before choosing any leftover spot. I laid claim to an area underneath a scrub tree. While laying out my camping gear, I noticed a black Chevrolet El Camino driving into the SFV area. A woman who looked to be in her late 30s got out and approached the group. She was definitely a typical biker chick. Then I heard Buckethead, as casual as could be, tell Domingo and Rocky that the guns had arrived. Buckethead was our chapter's sergeant-at-arms. He told Domingo that he was heading for the sergeant's meeting. I would have given my right nut to go with him, but instead, I headed to the common area with Rocky. Music blared, and the barbecue was fired up. Mongols were milling around, booze was flowing, and the smell of marijuana filled the air. Domingo, Rocky, and I had moved to the parking lot when a guy named Evil rode up on a black Harley Wide Glide. He smiled as he pulled up next to Domingo.
"Here it is," he said. He shut down the engine as a group of Mongols started to gather around the motorcycle.
"Stolen last night, right out in front of the bar. I told the prospect to take it."
What bar and what prospect? I didn't know. I was surprised that this frankly criminal conversation was taking place in front of me, since I had no official standing in the gang. They were usually very cryptic around me. I think Rocky had the same thought, because he shot a glare in my direction and told me to go away for a while. I did, but not before getting a good look at the stolen motorcycle. I would see it again later at Domingo's house. The run was shaping up well. I was gathering solid intelligence on the Mongols' firearm and stolen motorcycle activities, intelligence that would prove valuable to a federal racketeering prosecution down the line. I filled my plate with carne asada and moved to the common area near the barbecue, where Rancid, a talented tattoo artist, was putting the finishing touches on a full-patch tattoo that covered the entire surface area of Crazy Craig's back. As I watched Rancid work, I realized that Crazy Craig would now have to be a Mongol for the rest of his life, because if he went out in bad standing with the club, the Mongols would insist on burning that tattoo off. Customary practice for outlaw motorcycle gangs, and a burn that big would surely kill him. Daylight had given way to night. I was drinking a cold bud in the common area with six or seven Mongols, exchanging war stories, when a Ventura County Sheriff's unit rolled into the parking lot, not 50 feet from where we were standing. No big deal. We'll be cool. He'll be cool. He'll drive away, no trouble. But for the Mongols, a jubilant and carefree atmosphere turned deadly serious. They began to stash their firearms. Drugs were being discarded everywhere. Like a pack of wild dogs, the Mongols had zeroed in on the deputy. But two Mongols didn't hide their guns. I heard one of them whisper that there was no way he could take a shakedown. If he got picked up, he'd be going to prison for a long time. He looked at the other armed Mongol and said something that would rock my night. "If he comes up here, we'll take him." I was adrift, back on an exploding hill just outside the Camlo Valley, surrounded by the enemy. How could I possibly warn the deputy? Nightmare scenarios ran through my brain as the two Mongols talked casually about the cold-blooded murder of this unsuspecting officer. The plan to take out the deputy became more specific. The deputy stopped his car now and looked over in our direction. In my head, I was shouting at this officer to keep moving, to hit the gas, and whatever he did, to not step out of that car. I heard one Mongol say, "You talk with him, keep his attention, and I'll take him from behind." I looked around desperately for an out. There was no way that the deputy and I could win a fight here. We'd both end up dead. I saw a phone booth with a light directly over it near the basketball area. Maybe I could make it to the phone. I could call Chacon and have him call the sheriff's department. Then they could radio the deputy and tell him to get the hell out of there. I felt the sweat beating up on my forehead. If I was going to make a move, I had to do it now, before the deputy got out of his car. I started to move toward the phone when the deputy's car began to roll. "God, make him stay in the car. Don't let him get out," I kept saying to myself. The patrol car kept moving, continued on out of the park. I just stood there, stunned. I regained my composure and stumbled back to my campsite. The party was over for me. I lay down on my sleeping bag and stared up at the black sky, which now matched my mood. I was painfully aware that I was an ATF agent surrounded by outlaws. I couldn't get the image of the Mongols planning the murder of a deputy out of my head. I knew that if these guys learned the truth, that I was not Billy St. John, but Bill Queen, special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, they wouldn't hesitate one millisecond to put a bullet between my eyes. Chapter 6. Deep undercover assignments are always going to wreak havoc on an agent's nerves. But there are many undercover roles, even working inside such organizations as the Mafia or the Aryan Nations, where violent criminal activity is going to come in spurts. The undercover is inevitably going to have a few days or weeks of downtime, some moments when the criminality takes a back seat. Not with the Mongols. I quickly saw that their entire lives were a blur of potential rapes, beatings, extortion, even murder. Unlike the Mafia, gangs like the Mongols do not exist for profit. They have various illegal money-making activities, ranging from drug dealing to armed robbery to trafficking in illegal guns and stolen motorcycles. But the criminal enterprise is not the glue holding the organization together. For gangsters like the Mongols, membership means a 24-hour-a-day commitment to the life. They despise legitimacy and have no desire to look like anything other than what they are. Women play a complex role in these bikers' lives. They're called mamas and sheep and old ladies and are designated the sexual property either of an individual member or of the gang collectively. Women like Vicky, Rocky's legal wife and the mother of his children, were granted a measure of respect within the gang, meaning no one would dare disrespect her or put a hand on her. Rocky, on the other hand, could beat the hell out of Vicky, and no one would think to say a word to him about it. Probably the most infamous example of this twisted male-female dynamic, reported in Newsweek in 1967, was the case of an 18-year-old named Christine Dees, the girlfriend of a member of the Outlaws Motorcycle Club named Norman Spider Rissinger. For violating the rule of not giving her old man all her money, Christine was sentenced to a punishment ceremony. She was publicly crucified by Spider and his outlaw brothers. According to Newsweek, she stood passively and didn't scream as the bikers nailed her to a tree and left her there for several hours. When they finally brought her down and dropped her off at a West Palm Beach emergency room, she told the incredulous doctors that she'd fallen on a board with exposed rusty nails. The horrifying incident led to a national manhunt to capture the gang members involved and prompted a dire warning to both the bikers and their women from Florida Governor Claude Kirk. "This bunch of bums has got the word they're not welcome in Florida. I hope young, thrill-seeking girls who go with them know they can get their fingers burned, or in this case, their hands nailed." But after recovering from her wounds, Christine not only stayed with Spider, she reputedly wore the nails from the crucifixion on a necklace as some kind of perverse trophy. It's easy to say that women who are caught up in the biker lifestyle are victims of a dehumanizing, codependent relationship. But if you're around them long enough, you quickly see that for many of these women, being property of the gang is the one thing that gives their lives meaning. Almost all are there by choice. They're only too happy to put on that property patch. For all the sexual abuse and beatings they're subjected to, there's also a sense of belonging, a sense of power. While they are wearing that patch, they are untouchable to the world at large. No one can make trouble for them without bringing down the fury of the whole Mongol nation. Hanging out in the place in the spring of 1998, I quickly saw the kind of women who were only too happy to put their bodies at the gang's disposal. One night around 12, I was wiped out and heading toward the door when one of the Tohunga regulars tapped me on the shoulder. "Better hang out, Billy. Tonight's nude pool night." He pointed at a Tohunga barfly. I watched as the young woman sauntered around the pool table. She looked to be in her late 20s and had a great body, but she was rough, to say the least. She carried herself like a man and shot a game of pool like one, too. I quickly learned just what nude pool night entailed. This girl would play games of pool with the guys for money. If she lost, rather than pay the money, she would just start taking off clothes. A variation on strip poker. She ended up either with a pocket full of money or, to the applause of the boys, shooting naked. The boys weren't applauding her. They were applauding the guy beating her out of her clothes. She would win a dollar, then lose her blouse. Then she'd win a dollar and lose her pants. She might end up winning $10, but have no pockets to put it in. By the time she was down to her tennis shoes, Rocky walked in. I bought him a beer and we settled in for the show. It didn't take long to realize that the girl enjoyed putting on the show as much as the Tujunga boys enjoyed watching it. She'd line up her shot, bending over the table, making sure that everyone in the place got a shot of their own. As she bent over in dramatic fashion, she made sure that her nipples rubbed against the green felt of the well-worn pool table. Not content to be the floor show, she invited audience participation. The place, being a small, crowded joint to begin with, didn't afford pool players enough room for spectators to be kept at a respectable distance. But nothing respectable was going on here tonight. While making her shots and providing onlookers theirs, she moved her hips to the music that blared from the jukebox. I heard a loud roar from the crowd and looked closer. I saw that one patron had buried his neck between her legs. The neck of his Budweiser bottle, that is. As she moved around the table, it was a beer bottle here, a finger there. It didn't matter. Any kind of penetration was okay with her. The fact that she was someone's daughter, perhaps a sister, maybe even a mother, gnawed at my conscience. But as with many of the people I met during the investigation, the woman really was a willing participant in her own exploitation. And there was little I could do besides wishing that one day she might save herself from herself. Women were often the catalyst for some of the gang's worst acts of violence. Making trouble for a Mongol's woman, even unintentionally, could have the most violent consequences. I witnessed this early on with a guy called John O. I first heard about John O during the Memorial Day run. Several Mongols were standing around casually talking about a fight that had broken out at the place. Fights at the place were pretty common. But this sounded like more than just another amateur one-rounder. John O, a Tujunga barroom slugger, had gotten into a brawl with another local. In an effort to bring the misunderstanding to an early conclusion, he picked up a cue stick to clobber his opponent. But he ended up backstroking a girl standing behind him, breaking her jaw. Ordinarily, this wouldn't be any big deal at the place. But the girl with the broken jaw was the old lady of a Mongol who was now away doing prison time. Big problem for John O. Domingo could have ordered the SFV chapter to dole out a Mongol boot thumping, but John O was given an alternative. Domingo decreed that he could pay the medical bills and any other expenses incurred by the Mongol's girlfriend. He could also pay the Mongols for pain and suffering until the Mongols decided things were even. This sounded like a reasonable settlement to John O. Just a few days after the Memorial Day run, I met John O myself at the place. He was of average height, with long blonde hair falling halfway down his back. He obviously took a lot of pride in that hair. It made him look like the lead singer in some 80s heavy metal band. He stepped up to me at the bar, asking if I'd seen Rocky or any of the other Mongols. I told him that Domingo would be swinging by in a little while to meet me for a beer. John O was visibly scared, and he told me why. He had been paid a visit earlier that day by Rocky, who had explained that John O was late on his payment to the club. Rocky explained this to John O, while John O stared back at Rocky down the barrel of a .38 caliber revolver. A few days later, as we drank together at the place, for some reason, alcohol, drugs, lack of functioning brain cells, John O's payment plan collapsed, along with what common sense he possessed. After the trauma of Rocky's threat had worn off, he abruptly decided that he was no longer going to make payments to the Mongols. He must also have decided that he no longer wanted to live, because he made a critical decision to announce to his buddies around the place that he wasn't afraid of the Mongols. As a matter of fact, according to John O., the Mongols weren't shit anyway. After he left the bar, Corena, who was property of the Kid, president of the Riverside County chapter, not only informed Rocky and Domingo of John O.'s disrespectful attitude, but also agreed to participate in his re-education program. Corena put in a call to John O. and told them that she had a part-time maintenance job for him at the place. John O. needed whatever work he could get, so he agreed to come up to the bar. The SFV chapter, with behavior modification tools in hand, was waiting. By the time his many misconceptions were straightened out, John O.'s flowing blonde hair had been sliced off, and he was on his way to the hospital for a set of sutures and some plaster casts. I never saw John O. around the neighborhood after that. No one else did either. But the Mongols' SFV chapter flag, to this day in ATF custody, still bears John O.'s bloody hair.
End of Disc 2.